Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Alex Hartman is here. He's live from Amsterdam, where the IBC show starts in just a few hours. We're talking about this interesting technology, interesting product called Looking Glass. You won't want to miss hearing what it's all about. Coming up on Torrent.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, saving, and support, online at bgs.cc. By the new Ruby console from Lavo. See Lavo in your future at lavo.com/Twert. And by the Telos Alliance, shaping the future of audio, inspiring you to create the most exciting and engaging audio experiences imaginable. Visit telosalliance.com/opt-in.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. And today we're actually talking about something that happens after the signal leaves the tower. It's a pretty cool idea. In fact, it's a really cool idea. And our guest, Alex Hartman, is going to join us in just a minute. But first, I'm Kirk Harnack. I work for the folks at the Telos Alliance, where I do, figure out solutions for square holes and round pegs and things like that. That's what I do at the Telos Alliance. And I'm the host of the show. Also, my co-host is Chris Tobin. He's here as well. Chris joining us from a studio somewhere on the East Coast, probably out of the way of the hurricane. Chris, welcome in.
Thanks. Yes, far away out of the hurricane, that is for sure. Yeah, no, I'm here at the studios in Newark. I'm having a good time. It's in our news booth. A recognizable PR&E console, vintage. It works very well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. You're in the do you have several news booths, or is that the news booth?
This is the primary one. Then we have two others for the newscasts themselves.
Gotcha. I see an equipment rack to your right on my screen anyway. What's in that rack? Some 1RU devices and a 2RU device?
Well, yeah, the 1RU device is an MD, is a mini disc player. The 2RU is a CDR for some of the stuff. We have a lot of materials that are archived, so the archive they play it back. And at the bottom is the classic Telos Zephyr, the black face that we haven't used that in a while. We've been doing more work with the Opal lately, and it's starting to work very well.
Well, you know, that IP is the coming thing.
That's what I'm told.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never really done much with it, so I'm learning for the first time.
So Chris, you and I have both talked with our guest about this idea that he has now brought to fruition. And we've talked to him at the Public Radio Engineering Conference. And both of us, I think, were pretty excited about the idea that we're going to hear about today. And the idea is one thing, but implementing it, turning it into a product that other people like you and me, Chris, can use and actually put to work, or maybe our guest Alex has an idea to rent a service of using this thing. I don't know what he's got. So we're going to spend the next few minutes talking about the idea, what it can do, and then we're going to kind of spitball on ways to use it. So let's bring him in from Amsterdam. He's at the IBC show, which opens in just a few hours. Alex Hartman. Alex, welcome in.
Thanks, Kirk. Good to be here again.
I like your shirt, man.
Shoulder there. I've got an actual thing there going, so. A little problem.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll full screen you there. There you go. Yeah. So,
I don't get out of town too much, so I had to bring it to Amsterdam to make sure it actually worked.
we're going to talk about this. You've got this great name. Taylor, we're going to save that for after the ad. But we're going to do an ad first, and then we're going to get into this product. Now, from just that little bit on the screen, it looks like something that our buddy Leif Claesson would have written. So, I mean, the screen just kind of looks like a Leif Claesson screen, and I think you've got a little collaboration going with him. So we're going to find out more about this. And it's not an audio processor. I'll tell you that. It's not an audio processor. We'll check it out in just a minute. Our show This Week in Radio Tech with Alex Hartman and our co-host Chris Tobin is brought to you by my friends at the Telos Alliance. At the Telos Alliance, they've been doing research for years. Actually, you know, it's been 25 years ago that I first approached Frank Foti. And I said, Frank, you've heard this internet audio, haven't you? He said, yeah. I said, sounds awful, doesn't it? He said, yeah, it sounds awful. It really does. I said, do you think you could figure out some way to make it sound better? And he said, you know, that's a good idea. I think this is going to be a big deal. I think it's going to be a big deal too. Why don't you see if you can work on that? Now, I wasn't working for Telos at that time. That's 25 years ago. In fact, I was actually working for Scott Studios, if that rings a bell, that name. And I was happened to be meeting with Frank. We had a relationship going since I was a contract engineer. And so here we are 25 years later, and Frank has some pretty amazing products that the folks at the Telos Alliance do to make internet audio sound better. I don't know if we have a web screen or not to show here, but oh yeah. Okay. So here we go. This is an article that I just wrote. And actually most of the verbiage here is not me. It's people smarter than me talking about getting more listeners with the right audio processing on smart speakers. So I interviewed a number of people who, to know about this, who know what it takes to keep listeners listening for a long time. And in fact, one of those people was Leif Claesson. Leif has some great ideas on long-term listening over a smart speaker. And how is that different from long-term listening over, say, an FM transmission, right? So many stations now are putting their station, of course, on the air. They're a radio station, but they also are putting their stream on the internet. And, these streams are going to be picked up by people who have purchased smart speakers. I mean, the number one meteoric rise appliance, electronic appliance that there's ever been. And that's all we listen to here at our house, the Harnack house. We listen to smart speakers. Courtney Gould, there's his picture passing by. Courtney was also a big contributor to this article about how to make sure you're doing processing the right way for smart speakers. I also spoke with a program director named Rob Sidney. Rob and I have been friends for a long time. Rob was the program director for years at WLYF in Miami, typically number one or number two in Miami. And so Rob has some great ideas about that. And also spoke with Mark Manolio. His picture went by a moment ago. Mark Manolio at the Telos Alliance. He helps engineers every day to adjust their audio processing, mostly for on air, but now increasingly for their web streams. Well, came out with a number of ideas for streaming processing that are just perfect, that just really work well. And I must say, I've got all of my stations streaming using processing set up the way that this article talks about. And so I encourage you to go to the Telos Alliance website. I'll put a link to this blog post in the show notes, but you're welcome to go look for it as well. Just look for audio processing for smart speakers and add Omnia or Telos Alliance in there or Kirk Harnack, and you'll find this blog post. Really informative. Encourage you to look at it. And of course, encourage you to use the processors from Telos Omnia that make this kind of processing possible, that make this listening possible. This long-term, keeping these listeners around all day long. Listen at work, listen in the kitchen, listen on your way to work in the car if you're listening to streaming audio, and listening on smart speakers. It's where you say, hey, her name, I can't say it, play, and then your call letters or your station slogan. And you want to hear that audio. You want to hear it sound good and clean, maybe even louder and punchier than the competing services that you might be subscribed to. So check it out, this blog article. And of course, what I'm talking about in the article is audio processing that's available in Telos Alliance products like the ZipStream, the hardware, the ZipStream R1, also the hardware, the ZipStream R2. And the ZipStream X2, which is software, Windows software that runs as a service, so it's ultra reliable. That's what I use at all of my stations. And actually, the ZipStream 9X2, which includes Omnia 9 style audio processing. That's actually what I use on most of my stations, the 9X2. So check that out if you would. Thanks a lot to the Telos Alliance for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech, making my streams sound great, especially on smart speakers like this little guy right here. I think you know what that is. I dare not say the name. All right, let's continue on with This Week in Radio Tech. Alex Hartman is with us. Alex, you've made the big trip across the pond, and we'll tell you what, let's start back where we met. You've been working with Leif Claesson for a long time on something that the Telos Alliance was thinking about making into a product, and we just had other priorities. So we had to let this one go by. And we're working on other things that pay the bills, but this is a really cool product, and you've productized this. Tell me about what we're talking about here and how you got involved.
We can start at the beginning. So yeah, it was about 2 years ago. Leif sent me a piece of software and said, "Hey, look at this." And it was like, "Well, you rewrote MPX tool." Finally, because people have been asking for it. Hey, is there a modern version? This thing's 10 years old. And he sends it to me and I'm like, "Well, hey, I've got this thing. Can it work with this?" And that was, this guy, which is a standard RTL SDR dongle. You can get these on Amazon and, anywhere else for about $20-25, and said, "Hey, can we make this be the RF side of it instead of using a sound card and an external tuner?" And he's like, "Well, let me look." And so he looked into it, and 2.5 hours later, because, well, that's the way Leif works, is 2.5 hours later, he sends me a version, says, "Here, try this." And software development being really cool and fun always has its pitfalls, and very alpha version, it worked, but not very well. So fast forward a little bit, you know, a year or so goes by, and we start asking each other questions. How do we call things in there? What's the nomenclature? What is the RF version versus, what's a front end versus a demodulator in software? Cause you know what it is in hardware, but how do you refer to it when it comes to that? You know, it's very cumbersome and difficult to keep it straight. So we put it all together and we started a little bit of a beta test with a couple of users. And then I said, "You know what, Leif, what happens when I put 10 of these into a computer?" And he says, "Well,
10 of the SDRs know. or yes. 10. Okay. 10 SDRs.
10 SDRs.
All right.
10 of these.
All right.
Because these can only see 2 megahertz each."
Oh, okay. All right.
So
and the FM band, the whole FM band is 20 megahertz.
Right. So I need 10 of these to get the entire FM band. So he says, "Well, okay, let's try it. Let's see what happens when I pull up multiples," and so on and so forth. So we kind of took it as a personal challenge to both of us, as how much hardware do you have to throw at this thing to actually make it look at the entire FM band at once? Instead of a typical modulation monitor is a one-to-one. It's got a physical, usually a Texas Instruments or a Scilabs tuner chip inside of it, and it can only tune one station at a time. The problem we've always seen is that modulation monitors that allow for remote access, for instance, only let you look at that one thing, or it scans channels. You know, you have to go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, not the entire band at the whole time. And I'm like, so how cool would it be to actually monitor all of it? And by all of it, I mean 88 to 108 for the US and, you know, the OIRT stuff and here in Europe, for instance, it's, or free running. So you can just choose a range within broadcast bands that we've defined throughout the world. So it is made for the world. It's not made for just the U.S. market. It's not made for just the Canadian market. It's not made for it. You can see it's working fine here in Amsterdam. So we kind of did a little bit more research on it and said, well, you know, 85% of the global radio market is still analog. So this is really cool for that. And there's other problems that come with being analog, of course. You know, here in Europe, they've got MPX power limits or Stoken mask here in Amsterdam, and other things that have to be applied as far as a regulatory thing. Now, we started looking at it going, can we do it? And the answer was, yes. Yes, we can. it wasn't easy. It took a long time to get there, but we finally have a working model of how to do this all in an appliance or in software for certain instances. Here's a version of what we're using. It's kind of tiny. Wouldn't even know that that's what it does. This is a Lime SDR.
So
I contacted Lime SDR and they wrote me some custom firmware to do what I wanted it to do and the way that Leif wanted it to interact. And lo and behold, this little guy right here allows you to see up to 31 mega samples a second, or 30 megahertz of bandwidth at a 12-bit depth. So the RTLs are only an 8-bit depth. So if you know your bit depths of anything, 8-bit has a noise floor around, you know, minus 65, minus 70, somewhere around there. You go to 12 bits and you're down into the 120 dB range of noise floor. So you get way down there. And you can easily maintain that across the entire spectrum. And it'll automatically do AGC for RF and receive, so nothing gets overloaded. It's very, very, very robust for the unit it is. It's allowed quite of interesting things to happen with that. Again, watching the entire RF band at once. Then came the challenge of, well, how do you listen to the entire FM band at once? Which is, well, you only have one set of ears. So we had to develop a means and method of selecting the audio paths that you want while retaining the data that it's gathering. At the same time in the background, when you're not looking at path number one, for instance, and you're looking at path number 50, because we can do up to 50 at once, which we found was a good round number. We actually tried for 100. I said, let's try and see if we can get Chicago on one unit. We actually ran into a physical limitation of Intel's processors trying to do that. It failed around 61. So we said 50 is a good round number. Let's go with 50, because I was, you know, if you're in a middle market like I am in St. Cloud, Minnesota, which is a border edge city of Minneapolis, and we're surrounded, you know, we're close enough in, far enough out, so our two neighboring communities radio stations overlap. So with 50, I'm able to pick up 41 radio stations of unique value. So 41 stations covering two markets, pretty cool. So,
that's
really how this came along.
Now, at the very beginning of this explanation, you mentioned the name of the original software, MPX Tool. And probably not every one of our listeners knows what that is. That's something that Leif Claesson wrote, and it has the typical Leif Claesson look, as I mentioned earlier. It looks kind of like his audio processing software in terms of colors and style, but it's not audio processing. It is for demodulating.
No processing in there at
FM.
All.
Yeah. Yep. So the
goal is to verify. And that was kind of the goal when we set forth in this is, yes, he wrote the Omnia 9 and the 7 and the 9SG and stuff like that. So he's hyper involved with the last step in transmission before it hits the transmitter. So he wanted to make sure that what he was putting out of an Omnia 9 was coming back out on the other side of the antenna. Mm-hmm. And this was the tool to do that. And it's a verification system that your transmission system, it's the one thing that a lot of engineers can't look at inexpensively. Typically you need a very expensive spectrum analyzer or a vector analyzer or some kind of really good test equipment to go through a sample port or even in line to monitor what's coming out through the transmitter, but you have no verification on the antenna. So you can do the transmitter, but you can't see what's around you. You know, what's picking up in free space? What is the world listening to? What is your radio actually hearing? Can you multipath? Big problem. I can show you multipath.
Wow.
It's definable.
Okay. So I take it that I've used MPX Tool with one of the cheap SDRs, and I've just listened to one radio station at a time, of course, listened to, and I've seen two or three or four stations across a 2 megahertz swath. Now you're looking at the entire FM band, 20 megahertz from one end to the other, and I believe you said that you could, you can record, you can decode, you can do what with 50 simultaneous radio stations?
Well, you can do a lot with it. If there's several business uses and engineering uses. I've actually, even the little 8-bit dongle, for instance, Kirk, I've actually found antenna problems because I could see that the RF was asymmetrical. And I'm like, why is it tilting a little bit? And so I, calibrated, make sure my stuff was okay. And I put it against a known good spectrum analyzer. I borrowed a buddy of mine's Agilent and said, does this look funny to you too? And sure enough, it does. So I called up my buddy, the engineer at the station, and I said, hey, there's something wrong with your antenna. And he's like, what? And I show him the data, and because I can record the I and Q data off the tuner, not just like recording the audio, but I'm recording the actual RF and playing it back for him. So it's a spot in time. So I showed it to him, and he's like, well, that's interesting. So he calls his tower crew and they go up there where they're changing light bulbs. And sure enough, they find a pinhole in his 10 bay antenna. And that was causing a problem, but it wasn't doing anything noticeable on the ground yet, but it was messing up his signal enough that I could see it and causing reception issues because the RF was starting to move asymmetrically.
You know, this, you mentioned I and Q signals, and this is something that honestly for decades in my career as a broadcast engineer, I've kind of glossed over I and Q signals. And I don't know, about a month ago, I thought, you know, I should know something about this. So I started reading a bit about I and Q signals and theory. And actually, I got some ham radio literature that helped me understand this. And I saw a couple of YouTube videos where it was very nicely explained. I'm not sure I still entirely understand it, but I will say, and maybe Chris Tobin can chime in or you can tell me if this is at least close for a kind of a layman's understanding, if we capture the RF and we turn it into its I and Q signals, we can characterize it plenty well enough to do all kinds of things with it. We can demodulate it. We could also recreate it. We could record it. We can fully capture and characterize an RF signal using what are known as the I and Q signals. Is that a fair assessment?
Exactly. And it's good for lab testing as well, because you can generate certain types of variations in the I or Q, Q being quadrature. So you can test phase shift and such like that in a lab environment. So, and nowadays things are powerful enough. I mean, you can buy these things or this thing here, I've got a collection here, you know, this one here, or even this one here, which is popular with the ham radio folk. Because it'll do long wire antennas. So it's, you know, you can get any variation of these things pretty inexpensively now. I mean, the ones that we're using are a little bit more on the expensive side. They're not exactly cheap, but the ability of testing in a closed environment on a hobbyist, you know, like you said, the ham radio community, who's been using sound cards for years to generate digital data, or even, you know, I and Q stuff, and they're manipulating it in certain ways to generate things, is now brought to the power of the desktop because computers have finally gotten powerful enough to handle RF in software. Things like GQRX or GNU Radio, you know, these are simulation programs that use these types of hardware to mimic certain other systems. So say, it's like asking the cell phone industry, how'd you guys come up with 5G anyway? Well, they started in the lab with something like this, a much bigger version, but they started with something like this. So if you get into that hobby of that, you can come up with some cool stuff.
I had my experience with the MPX tool, and I work for the company for Telus. I know Leif, so I've gotten to use it a bit. And my hands-on experience was to put it on a little laptop and take it to American Samoa, to my stations there. And I had a little SDR radio. And, you know, in American Samoa, we may have a mod monitor there. I'm not real sure if I saw one there or not. But I did use MPX tool when we moved our stations to just double-check all of our transmitters. And we have, I think, five different transmitters, translators, full transmitters. And I wanted to check and make sure the modulation was good. So I used it with the little cheap SDR. So obviously MPX tool is useful for examining one station. And you can look at the RF spectrum, and you can then look at the demodulated baseband, and you can look at a number of different characteristics that are of interest to an FM signal, like your pilot injection. You can look at the RDS. You can look at all kinds of power levels, the audio, average audio power, things like this you can look at. And that's cool. That's cool enough. You can look at one station. And if you want to talk more about just that aspect, what it can, in fact, let's talk about that. We're going to get to looking at multiple stations, because I think that is just amazing. In fact, we'll do that after the next commercial. But let's think, Alex, about just one station. What are some of the characteristics you can look at? And maybe there's some things you can find out about an FM signal with MPX tool that you can't find out with an ordinary modulation monitor.
Well, the first and foremost is that because it is an SDR, we have the ability of, say you're an HD-enabled station. Mod monitors have barn door hardware front ends. You can't tune out the HD signal very easily. The SDR, no problem. So you no longer have to turn off your HD carriers to find out what your true analog modulation is. You can dial it right in and block them out, and it essentially ignores it and gives you a true peak reading of your modulation. That's a very useful tool there is if you are an HD-enabled station, everybody's got those Inovonics 530s they just had to throw in the closet because they peg out every time you turn on the carriers. As other things, I think the Bellars are the older Bellars, the same way the old needle ones, I can't even recall those things, but you turn on an HD carrier, they're useless. So this allows you to see what your true modulation is because there are rules against modulation, even though no one follows them. But there are rules of pilot injection, subcarrier injection, which this is showing in real time. Pilot protection. But it also helps you as an engineer from a tool standpoint. Again, the name is Tool, MPX Tool, is that you can verify things like, is my RDS coming out the proper way? Did I set up my encoder correctly? Well, I'm showing you all the flags that it's actually sending out, including the marching data, RT, PS, TA flags, and your injection levels. So you can start experimenting, like put it on a tablet and Velcro it to your dash of your truck and start driving down the highway. And where does it stop? Well, you can sit there and watch it start to fall off out of the composite scope because we show you the baseband RF along with the baseband of your station. So it goes down two levels. Focus in on 101.7, for instance, but I'm going to show you the composite audio. I'm going to show you the L minus R, L plus R, pilot, subcarrier, so on and so forth. And you can start seeing where those noises are. Again, come back to multipath. Same thing. If you have a place where you have a multipath issue, you can use this to see what it's doing. Not necessarily you can fix it because Mother Nature will always win, but you can better understand what's happening because when your manager calls you and says, hey, when I go over to the coffee shop, it just sounds really funny and fuzzy, and why can't you fix this? You can come up with a better explanation for your manager. So at a single station level, things like that. Again, numeric power, plus and minus deviation in percent or kilohertz, take your pick. 100%, 105, 220, depending on where you are in the world. And it also shows you demodulated audio levels. So not only your modulation, but your demodded audio. So how loud is it once it hits the speaker? So in Leif Claesson fashion, it is built around the same software as like the Omnia 9, the 7, and so on and so forth. So it has speaker calibration in it, so you can calibrate what you're listening to. Not only can you run this on a tablet, but we've developed hardware around it, and we'll get to that. But yeah, it still has that same feature that the Omnia 9 has, which is NF remote, which means I can leave this here in Amsterdam and go home. I won't, but I will. You know what I mean? I can leave it here and go home and log into my machine at home, and it will receive the RF here, digitize the I and Q. Here's the key point. Digitizing the I and Q, not just the audio.
Yeah.
And send it to me over the internet.
Yeah.
So now I have a bit perfect copy of the radio station here in Amsterdam that I can take back home, plug it into a 192K sound card, and feed a transmitter with it, bit perfect off the air.
What you just said has amazing possibilities. And of course, as you said, you could leave your laptop there, but this implies that a engineer, let's say that I take care of stations in several markets, this implies that I could very easily put a computer with an antenna and I could monitor my stations in, X market and go home, and using the remote software, you call it NF remote, and people familiar with Leif Claesson's products will recognize that, they could dial right in and look at this modulation
anywhere in the market. Yes.
Anywhere. Yeah.
My NF remote at home has like 15 different locations. I've got one in Salt Lake City. I've got one in Cleveland, Ohio. I've got one obviously in Minneapolis. I've got one in my backyard. And I've got one in Sacramento. And I've got one in Sydney, Australia. I've got one in the UK. And I've got, Leif obviously has one in Thailand, even though Thailand isn't very entertaining to listen to. There's not a whole lot there. things like that, where they're all over the world and I can log in and listen to them. And it's an extraordinary experience for guys like me who are curious about radio, but don't have necessarily the travel budget to go out to Sacramento and check out the radio just for radio. I'm not that into it like Scott Feibusch would be. not a world traveler just for radio. I still have to have bills to pay. But the fun part of doing that is that I send them the device, and they send me it's locked to your Mac address or your computer, so not like you can just pirate the software. You have to actually call me and get a key. I mail you the device. You put it on a machine. You tuck it in the corner, and you just leave the antenna, and you don't even know it's there half the time. Now, we've taken that the step further. This is the single device kind of thing. You can do up to 2 megahertz with it. Plus, we've gone into, and I don't know if anybody has a picture of it from me floating around on Facebook, but I've developed hardware around it, an appliance, more for the more commercial environment. Not necessarily for field engineers, but more think of iHeart, Cumulus, those guys, market monitors, where the engineer has 10 radio stations to take care of, so it sits in his TOC and monitors all the stations, because we've also built in things like SNMP is in there for carrier loss, audio loss, and here's an interesting one. We added carrier addition.
Carrier addition, what is that?
Yes. Backup site on the
air. So it's constantly pirates.
Ah, even better.
It's
constantly taking an average of where the peaks are on the RF, and if it sees a new one, it triggers an email or an SNMP trap to say, hey, there's a new signal here. Is it anywhere near you? Is that a problem?
Oh my goodness. It's a pirate detector. I think we got a little
run out of. There it is.
There we go. Okay. We're getting a little stuttering from you, Alex. A little lockup now and then. So a pirate detector. Okay. Here's what it should look like. If anything changes, let me know. The whole spectrum. Wow. The wheels are really going here. And I want to point out something that, and Alex can comment on this and Chris too. Putting this kind of device like in a remote market that you take care of course you can look at your radio station and its modulation, but you can also look at all your competitors too. You can look at everything in the FM band. And that's what we're going to get to talking about, Alex's device that he specifically engineered. That's it's a productized version of this that lets you just do amazing things. So we're going to get to that in just a minute. Tell you what, we're going to take a quick break for our sponsor, Broadcasters General Store, and talk about from Henry Engineering, this box. Henry's productized a lot of things. Hank Landsberg, pretty amazing guy. How many times has your butt been saved by a Henry Engineering product? Mine sure has. The Sportscaster, this new product from Henry Engineering, the Sportscaster, it is a mixer. And let me find my info. Well, there we go. While we're looking at the product page online, this is the Henry Engineering Sportscaster. Now, it's the missing link in sports radio and video cast audio management. That's a lot to claim, but let me tell you why. It's used with Henry Engineering sports pods to create an integrated system. So sports pods are these little boxes that go in front of the producer, the talent, the color announcer, and so forth. It mixes. Now, this is the Sportscaster. It mixes the talent mics and other audio sources. So it's a mixer. It provides isolated headphone outputs for announcers, for field reporters, for camera operators. Yeah, you put in your games on TV, and a producer. It includes a comprehensive intercom and talkback system for everyone, and it's ideal for school sports, video webcasts. It's easy to install and use. The Henry engineering sportscaster. You look at how this ties in. I mean, it's a whole ecosystem, and it's really cool. And you're going to take your sports video production or your sports radio production or both, if you're simulcasting, you're going to take it up a big notch, and your people will be able to talk to each other, coordinate better. Hey, camera three, get a shot of that guy down in the end zone. You know, wake up, camera two. I need the referee. You know, man, you can really bring your production of sports to the next level. And even if you're not doing video, if you're doing just radio, that's going to improve too. You can have a producing, send somebody along as a producer who is, you know, doing stats, looking after the flow of the whole show, coordinating what the announcers are going to say. And they're all able to talk to each other. Then you can, of course, bring in an external device like a digital recorder. Maybe you've talked to the coach before the game or a couple of key players. You've gotten interviews, easily mix those in. And yeah, you can do those you can do that with any mixer. But this Henry Sportscaster, it's a compact box. It's one RU. It goes into a rack if you want to do that. And again, it connects with these other devices that are part of the Henry Sportscaster line, those sports pods, to create a fully integrated system. Really, really cool. You can see there the diagram of how things lay out. Hank Landsberg thinks about what people need and makes a product that does exactly that. Now, if you want information on the Sportscaster from Henry Engineering, where do you go? Well, of course, you can go to the Henry Engineering website. It's Henry Eng, that's HenryEng.com. And you can, when you're ready to buy, go to Broadcasters General Store. Why? Because they're just awesome people there. They will take care of you. Jonathan and let's see, Jessica is there. Carly is there. Carrie. Of course, you can talk to Dave Kirsten. Just the whole family there, a couple of families and extended family, all working together at Broadcasters General Store. Or go to their website. You can go to bgs.cc, bgs.cc, and check them out. Hey, if you want to take note of their phone number, okay, you're not going to remember it, but you can jot it down right now if you need to. It's 352-622-7700. That's on my speed dial. That's one of the few numbers in the world I pretty much have memorized. 352-622-7700 for Broadcasters General Store. Thanks a lot for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, we're back. It's Kirk Harnack, episode 412. We're talking with Chris Tobin. He's here. And Alex Hartman is at the IBC show. It's getting ready to start in just a few hours in Amsterdam. And it's Alex's first trip there. Alex, let's digress for 1 second. We'll get back to talking about the big picture now with your product. But what was your first trip to Euroland like?
Light switches. The Europeans have a different light switch system, and I couldn't figure it out.
Well, you did, obviously. You got the lights on.
I did. I did. I had digressed, and I had to go to Facebook and ask my friends, okay, guys, how do I turn on the lights in my hotel room? They put the card next to the door there, and it activates the whole room, which actually has a side effect that I found out this about 20 minutes before the show. If you leave it there to keep the lights on and you go outside to go get a bucket of ice, it locks you out.
It locks you out
because it thinks you're still in the room. So your card key that let you back in doesn't let you in because it's like housekeeping, you know. Then no, do not disturb. Someone's lights are on. So
wow,
a very interesting problem to have.
Okay, well, there's different levels of sophistication with these. The cheap European hotels that I've stayed in, all you do is take, you know, your debit card, right, or your, if you still have a Sears card, just put that in there and it works. Now, some of them require a card with a hole in the right place. They have different schemes for making sure you're using the right card. But most of them, you put a piece of plastic in there that's the size of a credit card and it works.
Yeah, Jeff Welton mentioned that he uses his Tires Plus membership card.
Tires Plus, yes. Chris, Chris, you've experienced this on trips to Europe, have you not?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember many times going, I'm like, okay, I got to leave the room. Do I turn the lights off or do I find a way to bypass it? I'm going to find a way to bypass it. So, yeah, the first couple of times it was a dark room, leave and come back. Because I was traveling with some friends who are European, and they explained to me, here's the plan. Here's how it works. Remember never to do the following, as Alex found out. And I said, okay. And then over time, I figured out, yes, there are different methods of activating the lights. So I had a couple of different cards when I was traveling, and they worked. but it's fun.
Now some of these, and I totally get it. If there's no card in there, right, and you're gone from the room, let's not run the air conditioner or the heater, and let's not run the lights. But please leave the outlets on, because I may have something I need to charge. And most rooms I've been in, that's the case. The outlets stay on while the lights and the air conditioner shut off. But some rooms, the outlets shut off as well. And then you can't charge something while you're out having dinner or something like that, unless you leave a key in and the room doesn't behave like Alex's. Alex, how does your room behave with regard to outlets?
50-50. The ones next to the bed over there do turn off with the lights. So bedside charging, when you're gone, doesn't work very well. But the ones over here by the laptop there, those ones stay on. So. Mm.
Standards. There's so many of them. All right. Anything you said, you weren't used to sitting into an airplane for that many hours, right?
No, I was not. I'm living in Minnesota. I'm 3.5 hours from any coast, domestic travel. So last time I had gone international travel was Cancun, which was actually just a flight to Miami. And I got on a boat, it was a cruise. So again, 3.5-4 hours. And then, the last time I was actually in Europe was 1996, 97, somewhere in there, just high schoolish. And, I don't remember any part of this.
Wow.
We'll leave it at that.
Last time I was in Amsterdam last year, the hotel we're staying at was in the Arena area. I think you said you were in that area yourself. Mm-hmm. And we usually take the train in, but sometimes we had a special need. We need to go here or there first, and we would get an Uber while we were there. And the Ubers we would get would typically be a very nice Mercedes, just a gorgeous, nice Mercedes. Ah, man. But they would do that thing where the engine stops every time you come to stop at a stoplight and the engine quits. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as you let off the brake and touch the gas pedal, the engine starts right back up.
Yep, I had that this morning in a very nice S-Class Mercedes that picked me up, took me to the convention center. I was very surprised to be riding around in a Mercedes for an Uber. But the other thing that was shocking was a lot of the taxis here are like Tesla Model S's and Model X. Electric vehicles are amazingly large, popular things here. They're everywhere. On the other side of the coin, the largest vehicle I've found here was an imported Ford Econoline 350 that took up 4 parking spaces because everything else here is small.
Yeah.
Coming from a guy who drives an Expedition, it's like I'm a little cramped,
By the way, that whole topic of cars whose engines stop when you stop the car and then restart just in time to go, that's a pretty interesting topic. And as an American, engineering-minded guy, I'm thinking of, 10 reasons why this is a stupid idea. But it turns out that there's a lot of engineering that they've done that you don't know about. And a lot of these systems, they really have it right. And does it save fuel? Yeah, it actually does save a lot of fuel. Because idling uses fuel, but starting an engine uses a very tiny amount of fuel. So, there's whole YouTube videos on that subject, but I thought that was interesting as, all of us are engineers here on the show. Oh, yeah. Hey, which is better? Is it better to stop the engine? That seems rough, but no, the engine may be the same. The starter's not the same. And it turns out the fuel consumption is a lot lower if you actually stop the engine.
And there's a lot of rules inside there. Like you can't turn off the car. If it's like 10 below or something, it won't turn off to kill your heater, for instance, in the wintertime. So it won't do it at that point.
If it's 9 below, you'll freeze. So it's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So let's continue talking about this big picture. And we've talked about the little picture. Look at your individual radio station. But you've got a product. It'll look at the whole FM band. Tell us about the product. And then I want to spitball on what you can do with the product, because this sounds really cool.
All right, so the commercialized version that looks at it, 50 radio stations at once, we called it Looking Glass, kind of an Alice in Wonderland reference. the world through the looking glass. And it's an IT reference as well. You know, there's always a looking glass website. There they are. Yeah. Built on my kitchen table, as you can tell. in long nights and chat sessions on Skype with Leif, trying to make it all work.
Okay. Modulation Arts, Looking Glass, powered by MPX. And I don't see any buttons or knobs on the front of this thing.
It's a touchscreen.
Okay, touchscreen. All right.
Touchscreen. It's not meant for you to really interact with this box, because this is the one that, you remember, is going to be put into a penthouse suite at the local hotel with an antenna sticking outside for monitoring, or in your TOC at your radio cluster, or even out at the transmitter off the transmitting tower looking at everybody else. It's not really designed for you to sit in front of at this point. This is designed...
Oh, sorry, we've lost Alex for just a second here. He's dealing with internet across the pond, so it's not 100% reliable. Go ahead, Alex. We'll try again.
Sorry about that. I'm getting phone calls.
That'll do it. At this time of night. Oh, now we're sideways. Oh, there we go. Okay, good.
This time of night, Kirk, I'm getting a call from Minnesota.
Oh, that's right. It's not even 5 o'clock in the evening in Minnesota.
Right. So, again, we'll try again. So, it's designed more for the utility of it being somewhere else, and the screen is more for an at-a-glance, sitting in front of type of thing, just a quick verification. Then you go back to the office, sit in your nice comfy chair at your desk, maybe a 50-inch monitor or something over your head. And because, yes, I have a 50-inch 4K screen monitor that I need to use to display all 50 stations worth of data. It is very, very data heavy. Because I can get you real-time modulation monitors, meters, on 50 stations. That's a lot of little blinky lights.
Well, can the NF remote program with a hot enough processor in its host computer, you can display 50 stations modulation at once?
Correct.
Wow. Well, the FCC would have loved to have this back when they were looking at modulation.
Right. Right, and it's not only modulation, it'll measure, the BS-420 power for Europe.
Oh, yeah.
It does MPX power.
Yeah.
And it does LKFS loudness integration, metering and monitoring, and graphing even. So now you have a historical data of, you know, maybe you've got some bad audio in your library that you need to normalize, because here's a, you know, an older version of Stairway to Heaven versus the newer version you have somewhere else. Oh, well, now you can see it and you can hear it, but more visualizing everything at the same time.
So the NF remote program, you run it locally wherever you are, and you build the screen the way you like, and you connect it to your device, Looking Glass. I would imagine the bit rate required between the two is different depending on how many stations you want to look at the same time, or is it always the same bit rate?
To a degree. The way that it works currently, and we're working on several other options, is that if you're like, say you got it as a cluster monitor in a TOC at your local Cumulus cluster, and you've got 10 stations you're looking at, or 13 stations, including all your translators. You got all these stations you're looking at going, oh, okay. Well, it's LiveWire enabled, so it can go into your LiveWire network. And now you can use this as your operator confidence monitors going through your LiveWire network. You can also use it for various other things. And it does a new thing that not many people know about, and it does LiveWire MPX.
I've heard of this. Leif Claesson mentioned this in an interview. What is LiveWire MPX?
It is composite audio over LiveWire.
This is not micro MPX. This is a much higher bit rate, right?
Much higher bit rate, yes. Yes, this is actually using, you know, full bandwidth. This is a micro MPX. A micro MPX is made to fit through very small pipes. This requires about 4.5 megabit per station. Right. Now, that being said, to minimize the pain, as we call it, the internet pain, is that when you're using NF remote, you can select, you know, 1, 2, 3, maybe 5 or a common one device. So it'll follow you around on all 50. So I want to listen to DMOD 1, for instance. DMOD 1 will send me its INQ data and be reconstructed on an F remote. And from there, okay, that's the one you're listening to. Now we can jump over to MPX 21. It stops the MPX 1 sending of the INQ to your remote. It's not stopping on the local machine, the looking glass PC, where it, the device there is actually still running, doing its thing, logging everything, and doing its job. Just NF remote is just trying to serve you what you are interested in at that time. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of how we've broken it down from here's an appliance that does everything and aggregates all this data that's out there, because RF is really the last frontier that no one's looking at. So we tried to take an approach at trying to aggregate that data. And so, but humans, like I said, it's information overload. Ever tried to stare at 50 modulation monitors at once? You know, you can't relax your eyes enough to find out who's over mod versus who's not, you know, at an instantaneous looking, you know. So it's more of a reference point for a lot of stuff like that. Regulatory authorities and stuff like that would love something like this.
So my mind immediately goes to, okay, so you've got a penthouse suite, or you've got some place that's an advantageous high location to pick up all the FM stations in a given market. You've got your nice antenna that's doing that. Maybe it's a FM turnstile, or maybe it's a disc cone, whatever it is. You've got an antenna there. You're bringing all these into the looking glass. And if I want to bring the entire FM band to a remote location, what kind of bandwidth are we talking about there? Can that be done at this point?
I've done it over cell phone tethering, so it's 4.5 megabit. You do lose certain features if you drop below that, like bit scoping, not bit scoping, but the oscilloscope functionality, which is pretty real time. Because we start going into a very lossy mode on the INQ data, we sacrifice the oscilloscope to keep the audio stream going, things like that. So like 2 megabit, for instance, that's when that starts happening. But if you've got 4, 5, 6 megabit to play with, like I've got at home, I've had 6, 7 people connected to a 50 DMOD path system at one time. So
I'm not clear on this. Let's say 4.5 megabits. Now, is that to fully remotely look at and analyze one station or the entire FM band?
It's the entire FM band, but you remember you're only streaming the one INQ data at a time because you're consuming a single serving. So it's stopping and starting every time you change which DMOD you're looking at. So,
okay.
Gotcha. For instance, if I have 5 users, you know, 5 times 4, 20 megabit, I'm going to need to serve up 5 users on that to get the full experience.
So my thought experiment is it possible, is it the least bit reasonable? Okay, let's say I wanted to, in your looking glass product, maybe it does this now, maybe it doesn't. If I want to record the entire FM band locally there on site at the penthouse, can I do that?
Yes.
So I can archive every station, well, up to maybe up to 50, but every station on the FM band at a given location, I can do that locally onto a hard drive. And I could play it. I could play back the whole FM band. I could play back every station all at once if I wanted to.
And the rules of Moore and everything else that come along with that is that to record the entire FM band is 77 megabytes a second.
77
so that ends
megabytes.
Bytes,
not
a second.
Bits, not bytes. Okay, so to make that bits, you have what, times about 8 or 10 or so?
Exactly, well, 12 actually.
12.
But the problem is there's no such thing as a 12-bit wave file, which is what INQ is recording in. So you have to jump it to 16-bit, which is fine by me because I'm expecting a 16-bit SDR to show up in the next couple of years, and I want 16 bits anyway. But a 16-bit file. So if you do the math on it, it ends up being that a 2 terabyte hard drive is good for about 7.75 hours.
Wow. Okay. So what was that bit rate? Let's say 78 megabytes per second times 16, right? 78 times 16 is 1.2, 1,248 megabits per second. So a little bit faster than, so, okay.
It's, you need a lot.
That's okay. It's over gigabit. It's about 1.25 gigabits per second, right?
Correct. It's ridiculously.
It's more than I'll fit down my home fiber service, just barely, but it's more than I'll fit down my home fiber. Okay. Okay. Chris Tobin.
We have local storage in there. So,
yeah. Yeah. If we could just get pipes, you know, easily that were, you know, two gigabits per second, we could get the whole FM band. Chris, can you think of some uses for this? I can't help but think, take the whole FM band in New York City and record the whole FM band. Now, there may be more than 50 stations, but record the whole FM band and store it or pipe it somewhere else. Or let's say that I want to provide a service where in, okay, how about at Burning Man, I want to provide a service where I play every New York radio station on the air at the Burning Man event, and you can just take your FM radio and tune in any FM station that you want to, just because we could.
Well, and, you know, that's, yes, you could because you can, but then you have the DMCA copyright.
Details.
It'll be fine.
Details.
I mean, the details, right, exactly. Not to say that these kind of things haven't happened before, I think they're pretty cool. If you're an archivist or somebody does archiving of things in general, you'd probably love this kind of device. Not that you would do 7 hours straight, 24 hours straight, but maybe certain shows you just on a regular basis, who knows, you know, groups of stations, whatever. But I think it's a great use of the technology. It's funny that you're talking about the 192 kilohertz sound cards and capturing the stuff, because I was actually working with somebody back in 2002 who was doing experimenting with exactly what you're come out with. Unfortunately, the technology at the time was not quite robust enough to be able to make it a viable product. But we were up at a very large building in New York City recording FM composite signals and bands and spectrum, and it was fascinating watching this go on. And unfortunately, the SDR stuff just wasn't exactly within reach of a commercial product or a commercial venture, if you will. Fast forward to today, and you've found a nice way of making it work, and it makes total sense. And if you're a radio station, whether you're a group or a single owner operator, I think it's perfect. The price point, I'm sure, is still better than some of the other choices, and the flexibility is even greater.
Alex, I verified your math. So a 2 terabyte hard drive will do that many hours of the entire FM band, right? So this sounds like a project for a big honking building in Utah that the U.S. government may or may not have.
Right.
I saw yellow faced boxes in those racks in Utah. I'm not sure if that's the same thing. I'm only kidding.
Well, I do have one in Utah, but not that kind. The 50 path version does have a 12 terabyte hard drive in it, which gets you roughly 17 hours currently.
Okay.
So you can store almost an entire day on a 12 terabyte hard drive. But a 1 day archive. So if you put 2 12 terabyte hard drives in there and run them in tandem, so you got an entire day to move 12 terabytes worth of data. So it's always 1 day behind. So that's how I'm doing data retention for more than 24 hours, is that it's switching between hard drives. Because big hard drives are hard to come by and very expensive still. Hard drives themselves are actually becoming harder to find. Imagine that. You ever seen it? Go price a 2 terabyte SSD. Yikes. I never crazy. Thought I would have to go look at. it's a thing, and this thing has caught a lot of attention all over the globe. I mean, I've got a lot of people here in Europe who are coming to meet me here at IBC here in a couple of hours that are here specifically for that thing. And my friends at Nautel have graciously given me a corner in their booth to show it off. It made perfect sense for it to live at the Nautel booth, because it's designed to look at transmitters. So it's a companion. It's also at the Stereo Tool booth as well with Hans, with verification after the Freak Day stuff. Freak Day here in Europe actually used MPX Tool as the switcher and verifier during their presentation. So Later for a couple of customized versions just for that show.
Hey, so we're going to take a break real quick, but I want to ask. So if some of the stations that you're looking at are transmitting HD subcarrier, HD carriers, right? Are you able to, are you able to record those too? Whether or not you can actually listen to
all of it.
Okay. You're recording everything RF there. Okay. What about the tech to listen to those? I would think that that's proprietary or licensed.
There's a couple of ways to get it, but there's still a little bit of a legal issue on whether or not a security company in Russia actually reverse engineered decoding IBOC HD radio. Nobody yet, including myself, has really challenged the fact that, yes, it's a viable clean room reverse engineer. Nobody has said anything, but nobody is saying anything either. So we're working with Xperia and asking the question of, can we do a digital version of MPX tool in the future? Because we are going into it's 2018, almost 2019. We're in a digital age and we know that digital exists. We have DAB, DRM, IBOC. We've got all these other standards throughout the world that they care about that too. So we need to be able to decode that and look at that same data, and it's going to be a different data because there is no, there's no composite to look at. It's just like looking at an HD system, but we're going to look more at like the constellation and the bit rates and, the RF itself, making sure that you've got peak to average power ratios going correctly, things like that. Metadata, like this one here on the MPX side. Is recording the actual RDS data. It's putting it into a CSV file that you can download and on a daily basis and say, here you go, here's your entire RDS capture. Radio stations now are selling the RDS to Chevrolet dealerships, for instance, and they're putting on price tags of the new Silverado on there. Well, that's probably a value-added service that they're charging the customer for, which means there's now a proof of performance affidavit to say, here it is, I played it. All you had to do is trust that it was there previously. So this is kind of an interesting concept to do that even.
This could even be used for music verification, what did you play, title and artist, that kind of thing. And I think it's really interesting that even if right now MPX Tool, the software itself, and which is what's in your Looking Glass product, even if that won't currently decode HD radio or DAB or DRM, the RF notions are the same. You can still grab that. Get the INQ out of the SDR and you can log all that, which means you can also send it, in near real time, anywhere you want. The same RF principles and sampling principles all apply. Even if you can't legally decode some of that stuff right now, you can still grab it.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. Okay.
Hey, future uses as well on that.
We've got to take a quick break for our last ad from our friends at Lavo. You're watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech, episode 412. Chris Tobin is along in Newark, and Alex Hartman is with us live from Amsterdam. We're talking about Looking Glass. We'll be right back with a final thought in just a moment.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at, but have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the jock only uses once in a while. So why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like AutoMix, an intelligent gain-writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. dual-mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes, and enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavo radio tech at www.lawo.com/twert.
And when you go to Lavo's website, please be sure you do that. Add the slash twert on there. That way, number one, you'll go right to the radio products. And number two, they'll know that we sent you. We appreciate that very much. Thanks to Lavo for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. Alex Hartman has been our guest. And, you know, Alex, I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to talk about this. Do you have any, a last thing you'd like to leave with our listeners and viewers? Maybe a little prognostication about the future? Where can they find more information about Looking Glass? Well, kind of what's in the immediate future that's a little enticing?
Well, the immediate future is actually to finish the website. Right now, it just has pictures of Leif's dogs on it right now. We've been pretty busy setting up all the booths and getting everything ready and testing and making sure it's ready for. But that is coming in the future, but it'll be it's under modulationarts.com is the new company name. That's going to be the parent company for Looking Glass. And more information, again, come visit me if you're in IBC here at the Nautel booth or the Stereo Tool booth. I'll be bouncing around between those ones. And then I'm also going to be demoing it at the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association in October in Madison.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well,
we'll have a website.
I'll see you there. And Chris Tobin is going to be there as well. Chris, we got to go shortly. You've been listening the whole time, not said much. And just hogs the conversation. I'm so embarrassed at the end of every show.
Alex and I spoke plenty at Public Radio Engineering Conference about what you're now all hearing and what he's proud of. So I'm looking forward to the demos and talking some more in Wisconsin.
So, Chris, do you have any last comments about this? And you want to preview why you're going to Wisconsin?
I'm the SDR technology, I love it. I've already been looking at a few things for some other projects, and I'm actually working with a product from another company that's for wireless microphones and pro audio sound, has a SDR device for capturing the spectrum, just like Alex is talking about, and it's pretty cool what I've been playing with. So I'm looking forward to seeing his particular application, which is more detailed for broadcast. The one I'm using is more pro sound audio, but can do many things as well as broadcast. And it's pretty cool. And as far as Wisconsin broadcasters, the clinic, I will be doing a paper on the last mile, or some people like I like to say the first mile at remotes, and how to make it more reliable so that you can generate revenue at your remotes and not turn away money on the table. Because I've been working with folks over the last several years, and a couple of places here in the metro area and down in Philly and Washington, I've been able to help some folks make some money and make things happen. And it's simple stuff. Just got to think about it. We talked about it at PREC. And I'm going to present it at the Wisconsin Broadcasters Clinic.
All right. Very cool. Very cool. I look forward to seeing both of you there at the Broadcasters Clinic. Hey, coming up next week, we've got an amazing show for you. You won't want to miss this. My friend Rob Ashard is from England, and he is going to be live on Radio Caroline. I think he means on the boat. This is the famous pirate radio boat that sits off the coast of England. Yeah.
Yes.
He's going to be live from there. And so it's going to be cool. I don't know how internet works there, but I'm sure they have it. They're streaming. It's not quite like it was in the old days, although I'm sure they're running generators out there. So Rob Ashard will be with us in 1 week. He's on holiday right now in France. He asked me to say hi and promote the next week's show. So I can't wait for Rob Ashard live from Radio Caroline. And then in 2 weeks here on this very show, we're going to have a broadcast extravaganza because Chris Tobin is going to be joined by Anthony, is it Cusub from Ward Beck?
From Ward Beck, yes.
Yeah.
And I'll be at the CCBE, the Canadian Broadcast Engineering Conference.
That's where he's going to be, yes. Conference. Yes, I'm sure there might be some there'll be some libations, and we'll be talking about AES 67 and all the things that Ward Beck is doing to make that happen. And Anthony, I'm sorry if I destroyed your name. I only know you by Anthony. And anyway, we'll get that. We'll get that straight.
Well, anybody who attended last year's conference, the Ward Beck booth, the suite, the holiday, the hospitality suite was well stocked, both for finger foods and adult beverages. Sorry.
Well, maybe you should just do the show from there.
Actually, it would be fun. No, when I get up there, we'll talk. He and I will talk, and if we can make it work, we'll do it. Yeah, why not? It's a great show. It's a great weekend of papers, and some of the folks you meet, and what's that company again? Pippin Broadcast Technology folks. They have some fun there too. So
they do.
It's a good time for those of us in the Northeast or East Side, the East Coast of the states. If you can get up there, it's fun. It's worth talking to folks in another part of the country or the hemisphere about broadcasting and their way, take.
I wish I could go, but I won't be there. And one other show coming up is a fellow named Bobby Ellerby is going to be our guest on an upcoming show. He's got a museum of television cameras. Now, I know it's This Week in Radio Tech, and Bobby's worked in radio, so we're going to talk about radio too. But Bobby Ellerby, famous guy if you're into television cameras through the decades. Really amazing stuff. Well, that's coming up. All right, we got to go. Alex, thank you so much for staying up late. You need to get some sleep now so you'll be all fresh for the crowds tomorrow.
8 hours away, and I need all 8 of it. So,
all right.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care. Chris, thank you very much for being here. I appreciate you very much.
No problem. I'll look forward to next week. It should be fun. Alex, get some sleep and have a good time at IBC.
And my thanks also to Suncast, producer of This Week in Radio Tech, and of course to Andrew Zarian, the owner of the GFQ Network, where you'll find lots of other great podcasts. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.